Mojave Beach Productions.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana bring you stories of faith and inspiration, made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International.
Mojave Beach Productions and the Voice of Haulana present Dear Dean, Love, Mom. Made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International and narrated by Esther Luttrell.
Episode 1.
Dear Dean, I know you've wondered if I would ever understand what it is you've been trying to tell me since the day you crossed over. In my missing you, in my desperate search for answers, I was so busy shouting, why, that I couldn't hear your clear voice. So this book, honey, is my wholehearted effort to share your messages when I finally shut up long enough to hear them. I pray my mind is open and receptive and that I'm hearing you clearly. I pray my understanding is deep enough to grasp the significance of what I'm about to share and that I do so with absolute truth, with no shadings from my imagination or wishful thinking. I pray, too, that reason and good sense will prevail as I fill these pages, because to muddy the meaning of the book with fantasy would be to discredit everything I've learned since the day you set out on your journey. I'm writing this not so much in your memory as it is with your collaboration, though, of course, I do remember you. Remember you every day with all the love a mother's heart can hold. I'm listening now, precious, and I'm doing my best to tell it like it is on the other side, as you've told it to me. I've started this book many times over the years, but each time I stop before I even completed the first chapter. The truth is, I was afraid to tackle it. When I asked myself why, I knew the answer, but I hated to admit it. I didn't want to be labeled a kook. All right, there, I said it. I don't go to seances. I don't read paranormal magazines. I believe there are ghosts among us, but I don't care to read ghost stories. Gauzy figures materializing out of the dark on the side of the road, well, they bore me. I also don't read science fiction. I have enormous interest in galaxies and the incredible mystery of it all, but none in battling spaceships and pointy-eared aliens. I think it's only logical to accept that we're not the only intelligent life among trillions of planets. So there's no one on the few closest to us. So what? Have you never seen a block with 7 empty houses on it? It doesn't mean nobody lives in the city. When my son died, I was torn every way a human can be torn, despite the fact that I'm certain that life goes on with hardly an interruption on the other side. Knowing that did little or nothing to ease the pain. But then unusual things began to happen, and one day it all came together. Sentimental Journey was the name of a Sunday afternoon radio program I hosted when I lived in Florida not so long ago. One of my guests, Bill Guggenheim, and his former wife, Judy, had written a book, Hello from Heaven, that was 7 years in the making. Over lunch after the show, Bill told me that initially he had been skeptical about life after life. Judy, however, was insistent that in order to write the kind of book she envisioned, they interview everyone they could find who had communicated with a deceased loved one without the aid of a psychic or seance. Well, after that lunch, I never saw or heard from Bill again. Yet, 8 years later, his and Judy's book would play a critical role in the healing of a man so deep into the pain of losing his son that he was nearly suicidal. And I would be the one chosen to deliver a message that would cause him to look at the entire experience in a new and positive light. But let me start at what I think may be a beginning for this telling of Dean's tale. Up until I was 13 years old, my parents traveled a great deal. Daddy liked to drive while it was still cool, so by sunup we'd be well on our way to wherever it was we were going. When I was little more than a toddler, I'd fill the back seat with storybooks and crayons in preparation for our journey. Mama would make me a bed, you know, up on that shelf under the rear window. And it was really wonderful to snuggle into a fresh-scented sheet and cuddle into soft blankets and look up at the purpling sky. The air still smelled of night, and it still hinted of cricket clicks and stillness. Well, as we drove along, Daddy would whistle. Isn't it funny how people used to whistle? Wonder why they don't anymore. Anyway, going across the miles, I'd stare at the heavens, at the brightest star lost itself in an island of lavender that soon smudged into pinks and shades of orange. My first clear memories are of times when I must have been no more than maybe 3 or 4. I can still feel how my throat clogged with tears as I kept choking them back. The sky was so beautiful. I feln't something that I wouldn't be able to name for many years to come. I know now that it was homesickness. I'd whisper so my parents couldn't hear, "Why can't I be with you?" Odd that I never questioned who you might be. I didn't realize at the time that it was God. I just knew it was you, and I missed you terribly. When I outgrew the back ledge of the car, I graduated to a bed made up in the back seat. But I could still see up through the rear window. I still marveled at the breaking of dawn, and my heart continued to ache with longing. There was no one I could talk to about it. It didn't even cross my mind to discuss it with anyone. I really had no questions. I was comfortable in my aloneness. But I can remember Mother turning in the passenger seat and seeing my tears groan to my father, "Oh, my Lord, lass, she's back there squalling again. I don't know what in the world is wrong with that child." But her comments never bothered me. I didn't know her all that well, and neither of us ever took the time or trouble to know one another any better. As for my dad, well, he'd glance into the rearview mirror and he'd give me a knowing grin, and he'd wink. Then he'd go back to his lovely whistling. I remember in particular when we stayed the night in a motel across from a southern beach. I crept out of bed around dawn and hurried across a deserted two-lane highway to a seawall. I must have been about 5. And a storm was brewing. The sky was gray and filled with churning clouds, and a gale whipped across the sawgrass and sand dunes. Well, I saw an opening in the wall, and I slipped behind it to sit on stone steps that led down into the Atlantic. I huddled on that top step, and I was shivering in the delicious salt sprays, and I just wanted to stay there forever. Then I heard my mother's voice calling me over the sound of the wind. Oh, so reluctantly, I got to my feet and went to her. Well, she grabbed me around the shoulders and hustled my little buns back across the road to the motel, and there the memory ends. Looking back, I'm amazed the water didn't pull me into the ocean, but I was never afraid. And I never gave it a thought. I felt protected, as if I were wrapped in loving, invisible arms. And that feeling has stayed with me throughout my life. I didn't attend Sunday school, and my parents never went to church. I think, looking back on them, that they were probably good people, if I can be sure what good means. Nobody hit me. Nobody yelled at me or at each other. Nobody even really talked to me very much, but that was fine. They did, however, seem to care for each other to an extraordinary degree. Nancy and Ronald Reagan would remind me of them years later. I adored the man I called Daddy. He had the best smile in the world, but I was mainly alone, happily alone. And religion or no religion, I knew there was a God, even if I didn't know his name. My question now is, how'd I know? We lived in Tampa for a time, where my favorite grandmother, Grandmother Delamater, lived with Grandpa in a lovely old home off Bayshore Boulevard. How I looked forward to going across that wide porch and through the front door and diving into a feather bed that was so high, or maybe Grandma was so small, that a three-step stool was needed for her to climb into it. The front room had a sofa along the left wall where Mom and Grandma sat and talked. The feather bed was along the opposite wall, under a tall window. Now, at the foot of the bed, angled toward the sofa, was a rocking chair. And this is where Grandpa always sat, smoking his pipe, rocking gently, a twinkle in his dark eyes. He was fairly tall, mustached, and distinguished-looking, very regal. I don't recall him ever wearing anything but neatly pressed black trousers, white dress shirt, black bow tie, and a dark sweater. Well, occupied with the treasures inside Grandma's button box, every now and then from my place in the center of that wonderful feather bed, I'd glance at Grandpa, who'd give me a little nod. A smile would flicker at the corners of his mouth, but he never spoke. It was comforting just to know he was there. The bathroom in my grandparents' home had been added long after the house was built. It was in what had once been a broom closet on the back porch. To get there, I had to go through the kitchen, which was a small room with a tiny table for two along the left wall across the threshold from the living room sofa. One day, Grandma was preparing lunch at a sink. The little table had a tiny vase filled with fresh flowers in front of the one place setting. Grandpa sat there, facing the door as I came through. I had to brush past him to get to the back porch on my way to use the facilities. He glanced at me with that dear half-smile, and I lowered my eyes shyly. Now, why do I consider these rather mundane stories about my grandpa interesting? 58 years later, I'm in my Aunt Betty's California mountain cabin, and we're talking about our relatives. My Grandma Delabater was actually my great-grandmother. She was Betty's grandmother. Somewhere in our conversation, I mentioned to Betty how much I love Grandpa, too, but that I can never remember having heard him speak. My aunt said, just as cool as you please, "Well, I guess not. He died years before you were born." What? Died? Now, let me tell you, this is not what you expect to hear 58 years after the fact. I was stunned. I simply couldn't comprehend what she was saying. I mean, what if you had a favorite teacher or a best friend in your childhood, one that certainly seemed to be as much flesh and blood as anybody else you knew, and you went through your entire life thinking that someone of that someone as one of your best memories, only to learn that that teacher or best friend never existed? It's incredible. And I still have trouble with the notion Grandpa was never there. You know, looking back on it, I can see that all through my life, God's been trying to tell me something. I think the messages that Dean has sent from the other side are a continuation of that effort, and that I have finally, finally gotten it. My challenge now is to see that you get it too. In 1944, Dean was 28 years old, though I could never comprehend that he was over 19. Never too old to be told when he needed to brush his teeth or put on a better shirt. My kid, my friend, my darling Dino. When he died, I was with him. I whispered through my tears, "Go on, honey. Run along. Go home to your real father. You were only on loan to me anyway. You were never mine. So sore precious. I'll be along soon enough." And he went. But not before I sensed him standing in a tiny space between the hospital bed and the wall. His eyes were closed. The monitor gave out nothing but a flat line. I leaned to him. "I know they think you can't hear me, honey. But you and I know you've never heard me more clearly or understood me better. I know you're standing right there in the little spot at the head of the bed. And I'm all right. And so are you." I love you, Dino. But bye for now. Only for now, sweetheart. Husband Larry, daughter Brooke, and I drove back home that evening just as the sun was setting. I leaned back in the passenger seat and watched the stars twinkle on, one at a time, it seemed. And I thought, where are you, precious? I thought I knew. I thought I understood about death. But now I wonder if it's only a Hallmark concept designed to sell sympathy cards. Are you really flying among those stars? Are you here? Are you there? Is there a heaven? Did somebody come to meet you? Are you afraid? Are you really all right? If only I knew. If only I could be sure. In the few days Dean had been in the hospital, I never left his side. Brooke and I slept on our coats on the floor at the foot of the bed. I didn't eat. I don't even remember drinking anything, though I guess I must have. Finally, the doctor pronounced him well enough to go home. Oh, boy, what a sigh of relief. For the first time, as Larry was packing Dean's few things into an overnight bag, I decided to go down to the cafeteria for a cup of coffee, and Brooke joined me. I kissed Dean on the cheek, told him that I'd only be gone for a few minutes. The doctor had said they'd like to keep him on the ventilator until the last moment before he was released. Pneumonia leaves debris in the lungs, he explained. I want to make sure we've sucked it all out before we unplug him. Sure, I agreed. No problem. Dean nodded his consent and winked at me. You know, I never thought about it until now. He winked at me the way Daddy used to wink at me. Well, and so Brooke and I went downstairs, breathing easy for the first time since he entered the hospital. We no sooner settled at the table with our drinks than I heard a call for code blue over the intercom. I remember thinking, oh, thank God it isn't about Dean, and God bless the family it is for. Well, about then a nurse came running into the room, and spotting us, she blurted out, hurry, Dean's leaving. I jumped up and ran behind Brooke to the elevator, but nothing was making sense. Why would Dean leave without me? Larry had his things nearly all packed. Why would Dean just go? The elevator flew up on snail's wings. It took forever to get to the right floor. When the doors opened, I raced out and I was met by yet another nurse who reached for my hand, pulled me along, saying breathlessly, hurry, hurry! My goodness, all this to do over a grown man checking out of the hospital. My head was reeling and my thoughts were a jumble. And then we were in ICU room 3. Nurses were gathered around the bed. Bill, who operated the ventilator, was standing there looking confused and forlorn. Larry was white and stricken, and Dean was lying on the hospital bed, perfectly still. The room was absolutely hushed. Everyone moved aside so I could get to him. I leaned over to kiss his forehead. His hands were already turning a mottled blue. I covered them with a sheet as I whispered for him to run along. 2 hours later, we were driving away from the hospital. It was sunset, and there was no Dean on the planet anymore. He was here a while ago. Now he's gone. Where? If only I could know he wasn't alone, that he wasn't frightened, that he still was. That night at home, Larry explained to me that right after I left the room, Dean motioned for the yellow pad he'd been using to communicate since being put on the ventilator. Larry handed it to him. Dean wrote something, and then, as Larry told it, Dean glanced at him with the merriest twinkle in his eye, as if he had a terrific secret, Larry said. At that point, the ventilator bell began to ring, as it did whenever there was a problem. Bill or the nurse would often come running in, only to find it had simply malfunctioned. They'd hit the off button, and everything would be fine again. Dean sometimes reached over and clicked it off himself before the others could arrive. This time, though, Dean couldn't get it to turn off. Larry tried his hand at getting the bell to stop ringing, but he had no luck either. The nurse came in and hit the off button over and over to no avail. Then Bill arrived, but even he couldn't get the thing to shut off. When it did stop, it did so of its own accord. Everybody grinned at one another and shrugged. The nurse and Bill left. And that's when it happened. Larry said that Dean closed his eyes for a moment. When he opened them, he grinned broadly at Larry, wrote something else on the yellow pad, two words it turned out to be, and closed his eyes again, this time forever. At first, Larry was too stunned to move. Then the ventilator bell sounded again. A nurse saw immediately that Dean was slipping away, and she ran down to get us. At the same time, another nurse and Bill were working with the ventilator, but of course it was too late. In the commotion and the aftermath of all that happened that day, Larry gave no more thought to the yellow pad, nor did I. Several days went by before I could bring myself to take his things from the overnight bag and a box the hospital had provided. Larry was downstairs reading the newspaper. I was upstairs in my art studio where, I know for some reason, I had chosen to go through Dean's belongings there. His slippers, deodorant, his comb with the fine blonde hair tangled in its teeth, a Kleenex box, a couple of stubby pencils, and the yellow pad. In the middle of the top page was the penciled word in Dean's writing, Angel. It was what he wrote first. Under that, the message he wrote after he closed his eyes and opened them again, Am eager. Larry, I screeched, reaching for the stairs. Larry! I slammed the pad under his nose, pointing to the three words written there, the last words Dean would leave on this earth. Angel, am eager. Is this the yellow pad you were talking about? Is this what he wrote? I could hardly catch my breath. Larry studied the page for a moment, his eyes nearly overflowing. My God, he said, his voice heavy with emotion. The most important thing the kid ever wrote, and I didn't even read it. I bit back a smile. It wasn't for you, honey. It was for me. I sank down in a chair, clutching the precious yellow pad to me. Dean had left me a note. He said, It's okay, Mom. I'm not alone. Somebody came for me. I wish I could say that everything was just fine from that moment on, but I'd be lying and you'd probably know it. At times I felt the pain of his loss so deeply that I sank to my knees on the floor, and I held my stomach, gasping for air. The hurt was physical. It doubled me over. There was no place to go to escape it. I couldn't stand up, sit down, lie down, run away. It was just there. Like a fist in my gut, pounding away, punching me full strength over and over again. Would there ever be relief? I couldn't even imagine it. No words that anyone can say to you, no sympathy card, no matter how beautifully stated, no touch, nothing can ease the wild ache, nothing can soothe. So where was God who had protected me throughout my life? He was right there with me, and I never doubted it for even a nanosecond. I would say, when I could catch my breath, I'm sorry, Father. I don't mean to question your judgment. I know Dean's fine, and he's with you. These are just mommy tears, not tears of anger. Be patient with me, Lord. And the wailing would start again. At that point in my life, I was neat beyond comprehension. My children complained that the house looked like a magazine layout rather than a home. Larry often kidded that if a doodad on the coffee table was turned at a particular angle, it was meant to be at that angle, and woe be to anyone who dared turn it another direction. I confess, I do love interior decorating. Dean and I used to kid each other that it was time to move. We'd done all the decorating we could do in the house we were in, and he got as big a kick out of it as I did. That's why it was so odd to keep seeing a clear plastic envelope, maybe 9 by 15, on the floor, leaning against my office wall. I was making the effort to get back to the scripts written by aspiring screenwriters that I'd been hired to edit, but it was difficult to concentrate. Dean had been an aspiring screenwriter. Why hadn't I done more to help him? Why did I do so much for strangers? How many times had he come through my office door waving a stack of papers? Hey, Mom, he'd say, I've got a great idea for a movie. These are some notes I've written on it. Why don't we? And I'd shoo him away with a merry little, great, toss it in that box under my desk. I'll get to it as soon as I have time. Time. How could I know we had so little? Well, like I say, after his death, it was hard to keep my mind on scripts written by strangers when I had an entire box of Dean's notes under my desk. And that thought would dissolve me into a heap of sobs again. And yet I mushed on, as Dean would have wanted me to do. I came into my home office each morning, and each morning I saw that plastic envelope leaning against the wall. I don't put files against the wall. I put them in the filing cabinet. And I wouldn't have put one against that particular wall, even if I'd gotten busy and just dumped it somewhere in a hurry. That wall was around a corner, away from my work area. The envelope wasn't there when I left for the hospital all those days ago, and no one had been back in the house until now. But one day as I came in and I saw the envelope still leaning there, I heaved a deep sigh and groaned something like, "Oh, what the heck can that thing be? Might as well look at it." I pulled a rocking chair that I kept in my office into that little corner, sat down, picked up the plastic envelope, unwound the cord that kept it fastened, and pulled out a manila folder. The tab bore the word "Dream." It was written in red ink, and it was Dean's handwriting. Curious, I opened the folder. A sheet of white paper had March 17, 1994 written on it. Dean died April 17, 1994. I happened to remember March 17th because he'd come from his home in Fresno, California, to spend the day with me in the Seal Beach house we'd lived in for over 14 years. Dean wanted to shop for a piece of furniture for his new house, so we went to our favorite place, Pier 1 Imports. He got a wicker trunk that he was going to use for a coffee table and a smaller chest for a lamp table. We got back to Seal Beach early in the afternoon and were having a sandwich when the doorbell rang. It was a florist. It was a delivery man with a gigantic arrangement of daylilies. Well, I came back to the dining room table, puzzling over the card. "Thank you for everything," I read aloud as I sat down at the table. Then I saw the signature and I grinned at Dean. "Oh, you goose," I giggled. It was from him. Yeah, I remember March 17th very well. He had left that day right after lunch to go back to Fresno, about a 6-hour drive. Now, in my office, I looked again at the date on the manila folder. It meant that he had that dream that night, and I wondered what could be so significant that he felt he had to write it down and put it in a marked folder. I turned to the next page. "It's nearly 2 a.m, he had written. "I had to get out of bed to write down my dream while it's still fresh in my mind. I feel like it has some significance, but what?" The following pages were written by hand, and I hung on to every word. "I dreamed that I was standing outside a hospital. I was about 8 years old and wearing what looked like a white hospital gown. I was right outside the emergency room door. Paramedics were taking a gurney from an ambulance. As they passed by, I saw that the person on the gurney was me, a grown-up me, about the age I am now. I followed them into the hospital and into an elevator. They went up, then the door slid open, and they pushed the grown-up me down the hall to ICU room 3. Mom was standing in the hall crying. Larry had his arms around her. I was watching from the other side of the hall, but I knew she couldn't see me. That's when I realized an old man was sitting on a bench in the hall, sort of behind me. 'Come here,' the man said. I shook my head. 'I can't talk to strangers,' I told him. He crooked his finger. 'It's all right. I have something I have to tell you.' I went to him and he pointed across the hall. 'You see that rose there by your mother's feet? Bring it here.' I walked over to where a rose was on the floor and I picked it up, but the stem was broken. I took it back to the man. He took the rose and smiled at me, and then he disappeared. I glanced at the nurse's station where a doctor or an intern, a man in white, was going through files in a filing cabinet. I went to him and I said, 'Excuse me, could you help me? My mother's awfully sad. Can you cure me?' I could see that he didn't know I was there, and I didn't know what to do. So I walked over to a nurse who was writing something at a desk, and I said the same thing to her, but she didn't see or hear me either. All of a sudden, bells began going off in ICU room 3. Everyone was running in, trying to shut them off, but they couldn't stop. A nurse came running out to get Mom, and when they raced into the room, I followed them, but I stopped at the door. The room was filled with a light so bright I could hardly see. My grown-up self was in bed. The bells were ringing, and the light dazzled me. At the foot of the bed, I saw an angel appear. She wore white, and she was as bright as the light, maybe brighter. She was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. She held out her hand, and she said to my grown-up self, "It's time, Dean." The grown Dean said, "What about Mom?" And the angel waited while the grown Dean wrote a note on a piece of paper. When the grown Dean finished, he went with the angel. And that was the end of the dream. I don't know what to think. It was so real. It wasn't like a dream. It was like I was really there. It was so strange. I had to get out of bed and write this down. I don't know why, but I feel like it's important. Hope I can get back to sleep, but I don't think I can. He dreamed ICU room 3, the room he died in 1 month later to the day. He dreamed about bells going off and no one being able to stop them. And I have to think that when he asked Larry for the yellow pad and flashed that twinkly grin, that he had seen the angel. That's when he wrote the one word, angel. I think she said just what she told him in the dream. And I think he replied, "What about Mom?" I also think that she waited while he wrote, "Am eager." And when he finished the note to me, he went with her.
You've been listening to Dear Dean, Love, Mom, told by its author Esther Luttrell, and brought to you by The Voice of Helona in association with Mojave Beach Productions. The Voice of Helona theme was composed and performed by David Randa of Fesleyan Studios. Patrick McGranahan produced. This production was recorded by Dean Fairweather. Funding for Dear Dean, Love, Mom was made possible by the Forgiveness Foundation International, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the support of all aspects of forgiveness in families, communities, businesses, and personal relationships. Visit their website at forgivenessfoundationinternational.com. This is Jeff Evans, inviting you to soar on the wings of imagination to Mojave Beach Productions' world of audio entertainment.
Mojave Beach Productions.
I just want to take a moment to thank you for soaring with us on the wings of imagination as you listen to stories we're having so much fun creating for you. If you enjoy what you hear, take a moment to subscribe to Mojave Beach Productions on your favorite podcast app. And thanks a million.